Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you doing?
Good.
So where are we? What's going on?
Yeah, we're here in Building 34 with Dave Campbell.
All right.
Who also happens to be my boss.
So be careful with these
questions. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So now I have to be careful, yeah. But, you know, this is our, I think, our third installment of, you know, pre-PDC interviews with technical leaders.
Yep.
Okay. And Dave is a technical leader in the data space.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to ask him all about, going to extract data from him about data.
There you go. Metadata, as it were.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So, Dave, you're going to talk about ambient data at the PDC. What is ambient data?
Ambient data.
Ambient data.
Is that what I wrote in my abstract, ambient data?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Now, here's how I think about it. If you go back 50 years or so ago, we paid people to keep bunch information into digital form so we could process it. And the way I've sort of been running around like a madman in the division for a couple of years is to say that the cost of data acquisition has gone to zero. We no longer have to pay for it. It's just there for us to, you know, create value out of. So that's where the ambient data piece comes from. And if you look at the cost of raw data storage, well, it's effectively going to zero when you can run down the street to Fry's and buy a terabyte of storage for less than $100
or, yep,
you know, whatever it is this week. So there's some pretty amazing things happening in that space. So that's what I think of in terms of ambient data. How do we harness all that data that's just out there for us now?
Yeah, so that's a good question, because if there's so much data now, doesn't that mean that the value of the data decreases? When does data become noise, and how can you make noise into data?
Yeah, that's the interesting piece. If you go look at how we built information systems, you know, say 20 years ago, when we didn't have to key punch it in, but we still had to figure out how we do it. People in a data warehouse, let's take a traditional data warehouse, even today, a big part of the process is what 90% of the data do you throw out?
Yep.
And the interesting thing there is there was a decision just in the way that we made systems. Way up front in the process, you had to decide what was a signal and what was noise. Today, we can carry it all through, and then after the fact, you can decide what's signal and noise. And there's this amazing era of sort of algorithmic processing and data and analytics that people are now finding that if you can find statistically significant correlations, you can exploit them without even understanding the causality. So it's a matter of, you know, I can quickly say that there are 10 needles in this haystack. I don't have to ask why anymore. I can just go grab the 10 needles and use them. So it's a pretty amazing shift.
And so in order to kind of, you know, analyze data at that scale, is like traditional SQL, is that good enough, or do we need any new techniques to do that?
Look at the smile on his face. Because there have been a lot of good discussions between the two of us on this particular topic in this particular room. It's really fascinating for me because I kind of consider myself a technology archaeologist and such, and that comes from having all these gray hairs and being in this crazy stuff for like 25 years. A lot of stuff that the database guys had invented, you know, 20 years or so ago, is relevant in this space. And then you got the wacky functional programming guys coming from the bottom up to think that, you know, the world is all just map and reduce or something like that. And they're just starting to come together and learn how to talk to each other, like you and I.
Yeah. Yeah, but even there, like, you know, beyond that, because if you look at the older data, if you're now looking at so much data, because it's not all structured data anymore, right? I mean, there's like movies and MP3s, absolutely, which have some structure, but there's also other things, I don't know, like tweets or even search and things like that. So how do we combine all these different kind of data that also range from highly structured to completely unstructured?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you can look at it at those trade-offs at many different levels in the system. And it's funny because my conversations, if I talk to a database guy who's been focused on databases the way I started, it's a different way than if I talk to someone else. But it all comes back to sort of the same thing, is that separating the representation of the data from the ability to process it, I think, is sort of the key thing we need to produce. And the relational model has had tremendous legs. It's a tremendous thing. But people today, they've been dealing with systems built the same way for several decades, that they basically consider the relational aspect from the representation on disk in terms of how things are stored all the way up through the processing and the relational algorithm and such like that. And there is a way for us to separate those. So, for example, you could imagine having a large-scale system that just has a snapshot of the internet, and you're basically storing HTML at the bottom. Well, if you're doing a traditional data warehouse, how do I, normalize that data and put it in the database? You don't necessarily have to do that. What you can do is have functions at the bottom that produce what might be a tuple stream. So if I could, how many hrefs are on each page, and do they point within the domain or outside? And you could produce a stream, and then everything from that point up could use a lot of the relational heavy lifting or some of the stuff in the database space that we built over the last 20 years. But it doesn't have to be placed in the database in regular tables, as we were just sort of getting at.
All right, but so what you're saying is that if you have views over your data, that you can kind of expose your data in a kind of relational way, then from there on you... That's kind of a nice point, because like some of the things that people assume from relational data is like indices and transactions and so on, how do they kind of translate to this new world
where
a lot of data, I think, is like a lot of read-only data.
That's a great point. I think just like in data warehousing, more of the data is read-only. A lot of it's in terms of refresh and stuff just like that, but many of the refresh operations in data warehousing are the summaries and the aggregates and such. Much of the fact data, if you will, just sort of accretes and is immutable. So many systems today basically store data and stick it in a particular format. We don't need to modify it or run transactions over. It's just a matter of how do we process it there. So it's just sort of tipping these systems on their side a little bit. And what we find in a lot of these cases is that if I have a large system that I don't have to throw anything out, I'm talking petabytes of data, in the natural course of the data flow, you'll run an analysis, and that might take an hour or two to run over the large-scale data, but you'll reduce it into a set of data that will go into a traditional data mart or such that then you'll do subsequent analysis on. But the fact that you haven't thrown anything out up to that point means that you can go ask new questions of the data in the past. So I talked about part of the challenge in data warehousing is, what 90% do I throw out? People would think of the questions they wanted to answer. They build the schema around that. 2 months later, they had a new question. They couldn't ask it because they'd long since thrown out the data for that. But in this new world, if you can just save everything, as you get new questions, you can go back and ask of the system and produce, if you will, a reduced, in many cases, a data mart or an Excel spreadsheet or something that you can do subsequent analysis on.
So talking about like the kind of moving kind of the data closer to the user to answer the question. So, like one of the big things here in this building is like BI, right, and data visualization and so on. So what is your vision on that? So are we going to have much more powerful ways to slice and dice these data to have like a more human face on it to look at the data?
No, absolutely. I think visualization is key. I think all sorts of ways of mining things are key. I think that maybe one lens to look at this is that up to recently, we've been in a world of information technology where you built a model and then you basically put the data into that model. In many domains, we see that we're not building a model a priori, but we're, in some sense, deriving things after the fact. We may then place that into a model, but we're not saying up front early on in the process. So this is letting us realize associations rather than building the model and then encoding the data that way. So as you said, some specific examples. I was actually talking to someone this morning who's been doing some interesting work in an incubation. That a big chunk of it is to say that what sort of associations can we place in data and realize from the data and then use those in a probabilistic way in terms of being able to visualize and navigate the data. So one example, imagine there was an easy way, and this is one I've been using for a long time, a lot of people have pulled it off now, but in your calendar, you on Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4, you have an entry that says it's Eric's birthday. And then you take your pictures into the system, and then you've got 120 pictures between 2 and 4. You could have the system be smart enough to realize the association between that and effectively ask you if it wants to use the 25-cent word, reify that. And, were these 120 pictures actually of Eric's birthday? Well, yes. Then we basically build the model at that point, if you will, and associate them. But much more of it's sort of coming up and out of the ambient data through analysis and such.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. It sounds a little bit like a conservative garbage collection, where you know you don't know what the kind of pointers are, but you know you kind of assume and scan memory and find structures instead of a priori having to put very hard.
Well, it's interesting. In some sense, maybe another way you can look at this is to say that Chris Anderson, Long Tail and Free, it's like, he's talking about the world of abundance. We just waste things, right? Because we used to be really, sort of skimpy and stingy with transistors and then with this and that. When we don't have to clean up, be aggressive about dynamically allocating memory, managing it explicitly, we don't have to worry about purging data and such like that. It opens ourselves up to just hanging on to the stuff and then going back. And the larger the base in which we have to operate, the more insight we can get from it. So that's the sort of really key piece. And if you go look at sort of how scientific exploration and analysis has changed in the last 5 to 10 years as a result of that, it's pretty amazing. So the question is, how do we harness it and get it into the power? Regular people have to do this sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's democratizing data.
Yeah.
So another thing that I would like to talk about is it's maybe like another axis is like we have seen like that there's more and more data, but also there's this kind of move towards the cloud, and you've been working on that piece of the puzzle also for a long time. Can you explain a little bit to the Channel Niners about like SQL Azure and the challenges there?
Yeah, it's been fascinating for me. I've been in this space since a year ago, February, and I think I might have even mentioned last year. A lot of people today still think of the cloud as an extension, if you will. It's, I could run something here, I could run it in the cloud. So think about picking something up and moving it over there. And they also think of it maybe in terms of elasticity, in terms of some resources. If I don't have it here, I can kind of go rent it over there. The lens that I've been looking at this for the last year at least is that what are the scenarios which things just become dramatically easier in the cloud? And examples would include peer-to-peer communications. It's pretty darn hard because things are not always directly addressable. You think of two phones, they may not be on at the same time. You think about the stuff that people go through with some of these NAT traversal protocols and stop and turn and this and that. A lot of them require rendezvous in the cloud to be able to either establish a connection or relay sorts of things. So quite often what I see is that the friction to get from point to point is very, very high, but the friction for each of those agents to get to the cloud is very, very low. And so in aggregate, it's much cheaper to sort of traverse through cloud. So I'm looking for scenarios and cases that are really, really interesting, but are not necessarily about here or there, but how do we connect things via the cloud or to the cloud?
Okay, so you're proposing to use the cloud to enable transitive closure.
In some sense, connecting up via the cloud. Yeah.
Wow. And so then how, like, one of the things in the cloud there, if you want to achieve that, is that there's, heterogeneity, right? There might be, different, different operating systems or different databases. Mm-hmm. Is that something, how do you think that will work?
One sort of quick way of getting at that is it's nobody cares if it's SMTP, the mail transfer protocol. Nobody knows cares what's behind it, what kind of box is behind it, what operating system, this and that. So it does, in my mind, come down to protocols. And then we get into the discussion around, and again, if I go back to sort of the archaeology and this and that, it's fascinating to think, if you go look back over decades of computer-based protocols, which have succeeded and which haven't, and where's the sweet spot with respect to simplicity and reach? And it is fascinating at how that's evolved over the last two decades as well. I mean, I think back 20 years ago, we couldn't even assume that we had TCP. I mean, we had DECnet, Banyan Vines, the IPX, SNA. I mean, so just getting bits from one machine to another was a challenge. Now there's so much that we can take for granted at that level. And that's sort of the application, the higher level 6 and 7 protocols that we can focus on.
So now talk about the protocol. So one of the things that what you did with SQL Azure was to use this to stretch the protocol across the cloud.
Yeah.
Right. Is there? Did you have to do anything kind of, you know, special there, or was that kind of smooth? Or
was that smooth? No, it wasn't smooth. Here's the interesting part of it. You know, last year we were on this path to have a REST-based protocol sort of be the language which you spoke to the database service that we were working on. And it took a lot for people to get their head around that. And the thing that we found ourselves with, there were a lot of simple storage systems. It looked more like an ISAM. They didn't have all the relational capabilities. And they were all surfacing themselves in these, you know, sort of REST-based protocols, which made a lot of sense for them. The challenge we found ourselves in was we had this fully relational engine underneath, in which we built a highly scalable infrastructure for that we use, you know, now for some of the internal Microsoft services. But we're still kind of squirting it out through this straw that only lets you do a few things. And so we took a look at that and then decided to say, okay, what would it mean for us to have TDS, the native protocol of SQL Server, out on the internet? And I went back and sort of, again, did a little digging. And Sybase introduced the first viable client-server database in 1988. And a lot of people know that that's sort of where SQL Server came from, that same heritage. But they had to basically invent a number of things to get that to play out. So, for example, they couldn't rely on the authentication authorization structure, you know, whether it was IBM's or someone else's, because they were going to be across a number of things. In the PCs of the day, weren't part of the domain, if you will, securely joined and such. So they basically had to build their own authentication authorization. You had to log into the system that way. They had to invent a protocol to be able to carry queries in and results back. And they had to, you know, latency was a challenge, both in terms of the communications latency over the network relative to what TP monitors were doing, but also the use case and the patterns changed. So databases of the day quite often were built in systems around a TP monitor. You grab everything up from a screen, you bring it all together, you just run the transaction and just put the results back out on the screen. What we saw when people started using client-server databases, they would actually read stuff from the database, hold it out there for minutes or such, and then propose a change and then go set it back in. So optimistic concurrency control, the ability to detect these things, you know, these changes, conflicting changes, without having to hold locks on the database backend, sort of came about during that. So the bottom line is there are a number of dimensions in which innovation needed to happen at that point. So I looked at all those dimensions and said, okay, how do those things need to change to move things out to the cloud? And some of them needed to change as we went to build SQL Azure, and some of them didn't. Now, I'll talk specifically about TDS. So I hear a lot of people say, oh, TDS is a chatty protocol, or it's not, you know, WAN-friendly. TDS itself as a protocol has all the facilities to, you know, mitigate latency. You can batch requests up, and you can batch responses back to queries and such, so that you can do one round trip and do multiple queries and multiple responses. But it's up to the application. This is sort of the challenge. There are certain application patterns that won't work well in the face of internet scale latency. So things like a server cursor, where for every row I'm going to go fetch, I'm making a round trip, you know, that's a recipe to go slow. So part of this is, you know, what is the right way to sort of shape how people should be building apps in this new world as well. So to speak to that, we have several models of deployment, one in which the application logic is running, you know, in the cloud data center next to the database, in which case the latencies are just as if you're running, you know, together in your own data center. But we also think there are very interesting scenarios where people will do certain classes of operations from afar over the internet into the system. So we want to take a look at both of those things. So it was an interesting shift.
Yeah, I can imagine that. So it's interesting that you know, talk about batching and things like that. Because what you see now is that a lot of techniques that were pioneered in the database world, you know, like transactions and things like that, are now moving into the normal programming world.
I think programming world.
In the normal programming world, like
normal is in the eye of the beholder. Isn't
yes,
it?
Of course. Yes.
Has normal ever said normal in the context of a discussion with you?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like we are like this in the data land and programming language land. Yep. But if you think like transactional memory,
yes.
So which is something that definitely moved from the database into the programming language world. But one of the things there is, if you look at the database, what amazes me as a programming language person about database people is that on the one hand they're it comes from a very mathematical basis if you look at like relational algebra and so on. On the other hand, they're very system oriented folks. They talk about B3s and indices and so on. And especially with transactions, you know, it's not like a pure transaction, but then there's all the kind of, you know, modifications on, like, you can read or maybe you can do this. So where does that come from? So I find it really fascinating, this kind of mix of, you know, purity and even SQL itself, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, there's the pure query language, but then there's also updates and so on.
Yeah, that's what, so you touched on the isolation levels sort of thing. That's This is for all the database swamps. And some history from my perspective. You have a world of purists, and then there's the world of pragmatists. Yeah. And, you know, often the real answer is somewhere in the middle. And I think it's kind of fascinating, you know, again, to look at things historically. There were those people who started from purity and kind of relaxed things to get the pragmatics. And those who started from pragmatics realized things didn't work until they, you know, injected a little purity, if you will. On the isolation level thing, the way the ANSI SQL spec is written, the, you know, four levels of isolation, you know, all the way up to strictly serializable, and the purists started there and said, oh, I don't want any of these dirty isolation levels, that kind of stuff. Well, the pragmatists started in the other. So Sybase was pragmatic because they had page-level locking, and so they were overlocking things in general. So their default isolation level was read-committed. And other systems, RDB that I worked on at Digital, must have been more purist there because we started from the, you know, strictly serialized and then you relax from there. Yeah. But fascinating thing is, in the end, sort of natural forces led them to basically, you know, accommodate the whole spectrum. And we kind of saw the same thing here. We did MTS. We had a purist there who specified the default isolation level as serializable, and part of what you needed to do in your comp components was realize that, you know, that might not be the right thing, and people had to learn how to go shift that over. So, interesting, you know, mix of folks it takes to pull this all together.
Yeah, but do you think that when people take, when I see now, when I look at transactional memory, I think they're still in the purist kind of, you know, phase.
Yeah.
And do you think that, you know, at some point the pragmatist must take over, or but at what point do you lose the advantage? And do you kind of end up with basically just something that's similar to using locks?
Yeah, I think the challenge with transactions and transactional memory is such is that what is the closure of the scope of the transaction? And when you're dealing with the database, you know that if I go into a whole bunch of stuff, I roll back, I sort of intuitively know. What's the context that I've mucked with, right? And it's going to go back to the way it was when I, you know, roll it back. I think that is less true in the programming language because there are a set of real actions that may or may not have occurred. In the context of a transaction, if I show something to someone on the screen and they take some action as a result of it, and I roll it back, well, does that action happen or not? So I think the closure of the effects is a challenge. And, you know, if something fails, I want to take something from the transaction scope and actually, you know, do something else. And that's a model that I think it's easier today with the database because there's sort of this, that's the database, this is the seam, I'm going into the database space. And I think we're just, it's subtly more complex in the programming space.
Yeah, and also in once you start talking about distribution.
Yeah.
How do you think, you know, do you have any ideas of what, you know, how we should move forward with that? Like, you know, like if we're going to a distributed, like, cloud-based system where you said, like, where there's this, you know, transitive closure. Now you also have to start talking about, like, changes that are, kind of, you know, transitive across multiple systems.
This is another great debate. Your question was code for, like, you know, two-phase commits have any place, any relevance in today's world, I guess.
Yes, yes.
A couple of, sorry, maybe interesting stories on that one. Pat Helland and I, about 15 years ago, one of the first things I did with SQL Server is I added the resource manager interface that plugged into DTC. And Pat was working on the team that was doing the distributed transaction work. And so, you know, we started there, and now both of us are of the opinion that quite often, distributed transactions have no place in the large. One of the reasons is that The protocol is such that you're going to get a set of parties to cooperate and agree that they're all going to commit such. And the challenge is, if what happens when things don't work, right?
Yep.
So if I lose the connection, this thing, you know, it's the administrative commit. We're going to get on the phone and decide whether we can. That works when things are on a trust boundary where you can pick up the phone and know who to call. But across the internet, you know, if I'm a bank, I'm not going to let you lock up some of my records and then have you get flaky on me because I don't know how to call you to, you know, whether we're going to commit the thing or roll it back and such. So there's a, you know, trust boundary sort of challenge because that gets stretched on the internet. So many more of these transactional patterns are now turning more into a workflow sort of pattern. I think transactions still have their role. In fact, one of the fascinating things I think about, you know, different levels of consistency, and you can see that these things build upon each other. So, you know, inside SQL Server, we have spin locks for, you know, doing certain atomic actions, and we actually build the lock manager underneath its state. We modify its state under the, you know, spin lock, and then we compose transactions out of, you know, locks and such like that, and then transactions themselves can span. So these things all build on top, and I think there's a natural scope for database transactions. But there's a point at which we stretch them too far, and then we're getting into more sort of store and forward with, you know, testable. You know, I can make operations idempotent by being able to test them and, you know, retry things. So a lot of the techniques still hold, but it, what scope do they apply?
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting thing, because like one of the nice things about transactions is that they're compositional, which yep. Logs are not, right? You can take two transactional things and put them in the same transaction. Mm-hmm. But then at some point, that compositionality also breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And you mentioned PAT, and PAT kind of now has like this interesting spin on ACID, right? Where he said, what is it, asynchronous, commutative, idempotent, and what is it, deterministic, I think.
Yeah.
So is that something that you also, is that your new definition of ACID as well?
Yeah, because actually, see, PAT and I kind of wrote a paper to be... Pat did most of the work on this thing. I, you know, threw some stuff in there, but pitched a paper on building on quicksand.
Yeah.
That was a pretty interesting paper. Talked about a lot of these sorts of things. And the challenge is, you know, a lot of people haven't yet unlearned. I go back to the cloud sort of thing. When I've tried to hire people for this new space, you know, I often tell people when we're looking at it, okay, talk to some of the guys who have been working in the database space maybe 20 years, and I said, here's the challenge. You're going to come through the door here, and two-thirds of what's in your head is going to be valuable, and one-third is just going to be, you know, dangerous. Your job is to figure out which one-third is the dangerous part as quickly as possible. Because things are at a different scale, and things that applied for different reasons don't apply at this scale, just as you mentioned in terms of composition of transactions. So, yeah, I think Pat's got some... Pat's always been sort of in the mind, you know, melting sort of thing, you know, the sort of bleeding edge, as you are sometimes yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So you will be also be on the panel.
Yeah.
And so one of the things there is that we're kind of, you know, we have a lot of different people there, like from scientific computing and things like that. So in particular scientific computing, that's something that I think is very interesting. Also, when you mentioned in the beginning, when there's so much data and you want to... So do you have any kind of, you know, ideas about, like, you know, how SQL Azure, you know, would benefit the scientific community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I had a meeting today with some folks from the extreme computing group on this particular topic. I think there's a tremendous amount that we could use the database for. And it's not to say that we take all of this, you know, level 0, level 1 data and put it in the database, because frankly it doesn't belong there. But quite often there's metadata associated with, you know, various readings and results and such like that. And having that in the database be able to process it is very interesting. And we have... this interface that we built in SQL Server called RBS, the Remote Blob Storage API, that allows us to connect in rows in SQL Server that represent metadata with storage that might be on some other location, if you will. And there's enough in there with respect to testability such that we can avoid widows and orphans. So we can do link level consistency back to that transaction sort of thing. And so we're going to be building that into SQL Azure as well. And the idea ultimately is to be able to use RBS with SQL and SQL Azure to go connect into Windows Azure storage and the blobs there and such. And so you see lots of scenarios whereby we could have very large scientific data sets and then be able to have the metadata around them maybe in SQL Azure. And also this notion of being able to process extreme scale data and reduce the result into something which might go into a SQL Azure database or into a cube of some form and such, you know, for subsequent processing. So I think they fit together quite well.
And so talking about like different data types, like another thing like what we have seen in SQL is like things like, you know, spatial data and so on. So do you expect that, you know, in the future the database will be more heterogeneous where there's like, you know, many different forms of data are stored?
That's a good question. So and it speaks to a couple different things. We introduced the SQL CLR a few years ago, and it's one of these technologies where it takes people some time to figure out exactly how to get the most out of it. But we've seen some amazing scenarios. There's a bioinformatics company who basically stored information in blobs, if you will, in SQL or user-defined types, and then wrote SQL CLR procedures that did computation over the data. Yeah, we talked earlier about bringing computation close to data. Instead of having to pull things out to the mid-tier and process them, they just process it very close into the database. And they got speed-ups of like 50 to 100x in some of these things. And so you could imagine us using it for in one of several ways. And I'll sort of weave in a couple of things we've talked about. One is getting that computation close to data, using the query processor to restrict things to find the right set of data to go operate on, and then be able to bring, you know, computation, the full power of the CLR, you know, to it. The other thing that people have done is they've done user-defined types or blobs or XML, and then written table-valued functions that will produce, you know, virtual tables, if you will, but then subsequently join into things, so they can take a, you know, something of any sort of structure, and then use it alongside the rest of the relational machinery in interesting ways. So.
Good. So I think, you know, there's plenty of exciting stuff and plenty of hope. And of course, the future is in data and in programming. The future is in the combination of the two. That's fantastic.
And did you say that just because I'm still writing your reviews?
No, because that's why I'm in this building. I really believe in that.
Yeah, so do I.
Yes, so that's great.
So what is it like managing Eric Henry?
Did you say managing Eric?
You can't manage. So is that possible?
No, it's. I like different experiences. I value having an eclectic team, and Eric sort of defines sort of the boundary there, if you will. So I like working with Eric. It's always exciting.
Right on. So PDC, you're going to be in the technical leaders track, as we mentioned already. Yep. You're going to be basically talking about some of what we've already talked about today. Yep. And so people, please go and watch that session. It's going to be awesome.
It'll be fun.
Absolutely. And good luck with SQL Azure and cloud computing.
Thanks.
Well,
hey, man.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
And see you next time.
Absolutely.
And thanks, Dave. And see you at PDC.
Thanks, Charles.
You're welcome.